And it's another week. This is Andrew Wood with Hope Resource Center, and we're so excited about having my buddy and politician, which is weird that anybody would have a friend that is also a politician, but that is just one of the things that he does. Jason Zachary, State Representative Jason Zachary, is joining me today, and we got a lot to talk about. I mean, yep. The last time you joined me was... It was when the announcement by the governor that, hey, we have some pro-life plans for this session. I think that was before pandemic.
Yep. It's been a while. And then, yeah, it seems like it's been like 2 years ago, but it was just a couple months ago.
And then COVID came in and said, I don't care what plans you have. We're going to bring everything to a halt.
Yep.
So everything came to a halt, including the legislature. And so y'all came home. And then you kind of went back for a very quick – quick in terms of days, but man, y'all worked some long hours.
Yeah, we did.
Trying to finish things up. The beautiful thing about the state of Tennessee, and we could spend hours talking about the greatest state in the union, but we won't do that.
But we could.
But as we think about that, we have to balance the budget.
Right.
It's required
constitutionally. Right.
And so, which thank the good Lord, and every state should do that. The federal government should do that. We should balance budgets. That is a positive thing. And one thing that's been interesting looking across the state during this pandemic is you have a governor that is saying, look, we don't need to raise taxes on people. But then you have some mayors, which our county mayor came out today. Thank you, Mayor Jacobs.
Yes.
No property tax hike for the county. But you look at Nashville, what they're dealing with,
34%
tax increase, while people have lost their jobs and businesses have closed and they've been – I mean, just so before we went on air, you were like, so many things going on in the world, and there is, and we could talk about a number of those, but let's go before we get into kind of the topic at hand, which is the pro-life legislation that was passed. Let's just talk about kind of the shortened session that you went through and what that last week and a half was like. Kind of going to Nashville, and we were talking on the phone or we were texting, and you were like, you ought to see this place.
Yeah.
They had plexiglass up, and it's just a different world.
Completely, yeah. So when we went back, we had committee work the week of Memorial Day. So that's when we started our committee work before we actually officially went back on the floor on June 1st. And so when we got back, they had plexiglass in our committee room separating us. They had plexiglass all over the House floor. Anytime you got up from your seat, somebody was there to clean it. I mean, it really was they limited the number of people in the building.
Yeah.
So it really was this sterile environment. And it was funny because during when we recessed in March, it was at the, you know, when things went crazy.
Yeah.
And we're the hub of the state. Everybody's together. Nobody's thinking anything about it. You know, if somebody's gotten something, we've all gotten it because we work so closely with each other. And then you come back to this sterile environment. The hallways are empty. I mean, it really had an eerie feel to it. And Nashville, I mean, again, we finished 2 weeks ago, not quite 2 weeks ago. But even when we finished, which would have been the third week of June, Nashville still felt like a ghost town. I mean, it really, other than the protesters, the anarchy they were trying to create outside the Capitol and Capitol Hill, restaurants were half empty. Cars weren't on the streets. People aren't walking around. I mean, Knoxville and Nashville are very different. I drove from Farragut into here this afternoon. I mean, there's traffic. Restaurant. Yep. I left Aubrey's at lunch. Aubrey's was full. It's not like that in Nashville.
Yep.
There's no traffic. There's no people. It's very different, and it's about leadership in the different areas. And Nashville under Democratic leadership is just not taken the steps that we've taken here in Knox County and that overall the state has taken. We had a quick 3 week sprint. The goal is always to address the budget. We did that. We cut roughly $1 billion before we left. And most people think, it's $1 billion out of a $40 billion budget. We did it in a week.
Yeah.
$1 billion in a week.
Yep.
The revenues did not match expenditures for this year. I mean, we're $600 million short. So, but we have to balance the budget. So we took reserves. We didn't take out of the rainy day fund. We took reserves. The state had roughly $4 billion in reserves. We took some of those reserves as one time to balance it. And in 2 years, we'll be back to being structurally balanced. We cut roughly $20 million in positions that were not actually filled. So we took that money back. Every department cut 12%, meaning they're going to withhold their budget, and hopefully it's just temporary.
Yeah.
But if not, that 12% is gone. So you referenced it in your opening. unlike other states and other areas, we didn't raise taxes. We still were able to balance the budget. We were as physically conservative as possible. We still got great legislation passed. Not everything we wanted to get passed, but got great legislation passed. Here in Knox County, credit to Mayor Jacobs. He furloughed 500 people, made significant cuts, didn't raise our taxes. And then you've got a place, one of the great places in Tennessee that's unfortunately run by a Democrat, 34% tax increase. He gave
There in Nashville,
he gave $4.9 million in raises, a 1% cost of living adjustment, the expenditures in their budget. And then he hit his people in Nashville 34%. Yeah. Man, how's that going to affect a recovery? So from an economic perspective, Tennessee, because we're the lowest debt state in the nation, we're the number one in fiscal stability, it hit us hard. But, man, we have sprung back. Our unemployment rate just as a couple of days ago was announced, and it's already almost down to 10%, which is amazing that we're already at that point. Out of the 630,000 people that filed for unemployment, we're now only paying only 293,000 of those, 263,000 of those. So the recovery and how quickly we've sprung back, it's a credit to how conservative we've been over the last 10 years.
Well, that's been the interesting thing watching all of this as just kind of a spectator even, and saying, okay, in March, you know, things kind of hit the fan and we were like, oh, what's going to happen?
Sure.
Nobody knew what the virus was. And so places are closing and it's kind of being mandated in many areas. And then we get through that, or what we seem like we got through it. But watching that unemployment number in Tennessee was hard to watch.
Yeah.
And watching the unemployment number across the country after seeing some of the amazing gains that we've seen over the last couple years, record gains from an economic standpoint, to seeing all of that wiped out.
All of it.
All of it, and then some.
Self-inflicted.
And that was the hardest part. It wasn't like 2008 when some bad things occurred and you're looking at the banking industry and you're looking at different decisions. You're like, okay, this is a little bit different. This was administrations and governmental entities saying, stop going to work.
Yeah.
And then you have businesses going, well, then I don't know if my business will ever come back. And many have been lost forever.
Unfortunately.
And that's been the hard part, not downgrading, you know, what COVID is and all of those things. But all of that has to be, and that's what I've been telling people. And the best illustration I can give is when we see a school bus crash, what's the first thing people say? We need seatbelts on school buses. Okay. There's not seatbelts on school buses. They're still not. And the reason is because we don't make decisions based off of emotion.
Right.
There's a reason why there's not school buses or not seatbelts on school buses. There's a reason for that. And policy reflects that. And so oftentimes what we see is we see knee-jerk reactions by leaders, and put leaders in quotes, when it comes to these type things, and they make decisions on the fly. And then 3 months down the road, you're like, oh, no, that was not what we needed to do. Instead of sitting down and going, okay, we need to look at what this is doing to our nursing homes. We need to look at what this is doing to our schools. We need to look at what this is doing across the board, but also what it's doing to our economy. You can look at all of those things, and frankly, politicians should. And the frustrating part for me was when you would have those conversations, you were, you don't care about the vulnerable. I'm going, excuse me, that's what I do for a living. That's exactly why I care about the vulnerable. But we have to, from a policy standpoint, look at all of those things at the same time and make those decisions. And I think the governor has done, he's dealt with tornadoes, he's dealt with the pandemic, he's dealt with all of this, and I think he's done just an absolute amazing job.
He really has. And you think about it, Andrew, as a leader, when you make decisions, whether you're leading Hope, whether you're the business I run, whatever it is, I mean, you make decisions based on factors, based on data, based on the environment, the environment, the market. You pull all these factors together to make decisions. Well, you're making decisions for 6.8 million people, and every week the experts are giving you different data.
Literally,
I was on those calls with Vandy or whoever it was. They would say one thing one week. The next week they would come back with vastly different projections. Man, you can't make decisions. Yeah. He literally was making weekly decisions on a moving target. And it's for 6.8 million people in a $40 billion budget. I mean, you think a smaller company can't even do that. You're trying to do that for the state.
Yeah.
And to your point about knee-jerk reactions, we have tried to be so steady and methodical, because Washington's a perfect example. Yep. Washington is the epitome of knee-jerk reactions, yep, and their knee-jerk reaction to unemployment. This $600 that people mm-hmm. get now for doing nothing till July 31st. I mean, it was helpful for so many people, and I got that. But it was literally $600 for anybody, whether you made $10 an hour or $80,000 a year. Everyone got $600 plus the state portion. Mm-hmm. And so that has created a situation. We got a big employer here in Knox County, 1,800 employees. He couldn't get 800 of them to come back. And
because they're making more money.
They're making more money not working. And so Washington's a classic example where, yes, we needed to help people, but, man, they went way beyond what should have been done. And to say you can at least make what you make now, or you can make 80% of what you make now and work through a verification process, man, they just passed a bill, printed money, and off we were going. And then come July 31st, many of those jobs have been filled. People are going to try to go back to those jobs after losing that $600. Mm-hmm. Man, they're not going to be able to find a place to work.
Yep.
So just the economic impact of this is not over. We're going to see something else happen in August when all these people start losing their $600, or Washington's going to step back in, knee-jerk reaction again, and then just float more money
Here's what I predict, and it's not a good prediction.
No.
But I predict they step back in. I think this is inching us closer to a universal basic income.
Basic income, sure.
That's what, you know, Andrew Yang called for that. He was a presidential candidate. I mean, I think we're inching closer to that, and I think we're inching closer to that $600 not going away and being a thing. But we'll see what happens. But looking at what the state has done, and that's what I kept thinking about. And even at the Woodhouse, I mean, my kids, we say prayers at our meals and every night. And even my kids are praying for leadership and the governor and because I can't imagine what the governor's dealing with, because he has to take this serious. He can't be flippant. But he also has to listen to experts that are changing their minds each week based on data, based on good data, based on bad data. Some of the data we've seen, we know was bad.
Right.
And completely inaccurate.
And that's where we're talking about the models and the projections.
The models were way off. And then you have places like, and we've talked about Governor Cuomo multiple times on this show, because what you had in New York, you had this governor who was celebrated, but he literally put policies in place that were taking the lives of folks living in nursing homes.
That's right.
But the policies actually took the lives of people. And he didn't get any flack for it.
Right.
And as we watch these things, and I look and, okay, Governor Lee is also at the same time dealing with the tornadoes in Chattanooga, tornadoes in Nashville, dealing with unemployment at record high. And while he's doing that, he's going, well, I don't want to raise taxes. We're not about raising
That's
taxes,
but
we got to have revenue. And I even heard some people, you know, say, well, because of this budget decision, these budget cuts, my raise is not coming in. I'm going, you got to think about the revenue here.
Right.
Like, I know that doesn't work well for your bank account, but the state has to operate with the revenue that's coming in.
That's right.
And in order to get more revenue, they either make cuts or they raise your taxes.
Right.
And then your raise is out the window anyway.
Sure.
Because they've raised your taxes.
That's right.
And so it's just, but again, those are logical conversations that have to be had concerning policy. And I feel like we're in a time where logical conversations about anything are frowned upon and not welcome.
They become
in the
far and
few sphere.
Between, unfortunately.
It is. Yeah. It's just been, it's been a bonkers of a time. We've used this COVID time, this kind of quarantine season, whatever you want to call it, as a time to kind of reset a lot of things in our lives at the Woodhouse and what our family looks like and priorities and all of those things, while also understanding there are people that have been affected by this, that have lost their job, that have been sick, that have lost loved ones. And trying to walk through all of that is difficult. When we get back, we're going to shift from that conversation, because we could spend hours on that, and look at some amazing legislation that was passed right there last minute. And so I want to, as much as we can, do the ins and outs of what those meetings looked like to get us to the legislation that came out celebrating life. We'll be back.
I didn't care if it cost me a friend or two. I remember getting baptized in cold water, but right
So as we continue the conversation today with Representative Jason Zachary, Jason, as we looked at the last couple days of session this year, it came out of nowhere. I thought we weren't going to see any major pro-life legislation. I had a conversation. I was actually in Washington D.C. at the March for Life, and I talked to somebody within the administration. We were texting back and forth about the governor's administration about some major pro-life. I text you then, yeah. and then I had a conversation about what that was going to look like, and I was so excited. And then the pandemic hit, and we thought, well, that's probably going to be kicked to next year.
Yeah.
And then boom.
Surprise.
And then boom, I'm getting notifications and messages of people going, did you see this? I was like, no, I've kind of taken a fast from Twitter for a while. And I was like, oh, we passed it.
Yeah.
And so let's walk through. We'll get into the details of the legislation in a second. But I think some people are like, oh, it was behind closed doors meetings and all of these things. I've seen behind the curtain. I understand how politics works. And in order to kind of move the ball down the field, at times, some meetings have to occur, some give and take occurs in order to get a budget amendment or in order to get this involved. And so walk us through as much as you can on some of those things that had to occur to get us to where we are.
Sure. So we went through those 3 weeks and we got to the last week. I don't remember exactly. I mean, really, we were there Monday through Friday. I would leave home 6:30 or 7 on Monday. I wouldn't get back till 7 or 8 Friday night for 3 straight weeks. Wow. So, I mean, honestly, the days blur together, so I can't remember exactly.
You should get a plane.
I should get a plane. I think, I wonder if Joy 620 has a
that
plane.
That would go really well on the campaign trail
yeah,
next time.
That's right. Me flying in my private Joy 620. Bob Bell could fly me over.
Maybe a helicopter.
Yeah. But I can't remember what day it was, but the House passed it. And that was never a question. The House is extremely conservative. And we are different from the Senate. I mean, we push forward conservative principles, fight for those, and very aggressive in doing that. And the Senate's just a little bit different how they approach. But the House had every intention of passing it. The people of Tennessee send us there. We're the House of Representatives. We're the people's House. We're elected every 2 years. They send us there to do a job. So we're intent to do it. And so we passed the legislation on the House side. And we really thought it's unfortunate the Senate's not going to be able to pick it up and pass it, but we're going to do our job and pass it. Well, as the budget negotiations, the budget negotiations is truly a closed door. You have some real back and forth, and you kind of hammer it out with budget and things that you don't do in a committee with budget research analysts, the fiscal review committee. I mean, it's a massive room of people, and then you take that to the committee. Then you do all that stuff through the committee process. There's so much work that goes on behind the scenes. Then you go through the committee process, and so with that budget, as we were walking through that budget process, it became clear that some of the House initiatives were different than the Senate initiatives. And just like with any negotiation, we were able to leverage and use the pro-life bill as leverage and as a way to be able to bring the Senate on board. We were able to leverage the budget. I'm sorry. We leveraged the budget as a way to bring the Senate on board with the pro-life legislation and being able to work together about some various initiatives, saying we'll be able to do these things if you help us get this pro-life bill passed. We know we're short. We know time is running out, but this is worth fighting. I mean, there's no more important issue than life, being a voice for the unborn. And so the Senate, Senator McNally, to his credit, he's pro-life, and he said, yeah, let's do it. We got to make this happen. So the House passed it. Again, everything complete transparency. I know some of that. I got some of that too. Oh my gosh, under the cover of darkness behind everything it goes through the committee process. It's streamed. You can be there in person. Anybody that wants to watch can. And so the House passed it. And then it was after midnight on that last day. The Senate passed it on the floor. They debated it. Republicans voted for, Democrats voted against. And it is literally the most exhaustive, extensive pro-life legislation that's ever been passed in the country.
And I think the folks need to understand that what you just described is politics. I mean,
that is
how the process works. It's the same thing on a minor scale. When my wife and I are sitting down and looking at the budget, there's give and take. I really want this and you really want that, but we also really need to do this and we need to do that. And it is as simple as, hey, honey, this is how much revenue we have coming in.
That's right.
And if we don't have more revenue, then we have to get a loan, which is like a tax. And so we're going to have to pay on that.
Right.
And that may take care of us for now, but we're eventually going to have to pay for it, or our kids are going to have to pay for it. And in the same way, these are the conversations that are occurring in Nashville. on a much larger scale, because you're dealing with $40 billion,
right,
of, look, we got to make cuts, or we got to raise the taxes or on our people. Or we can take from the reserve, which is a no interest, but we're taking it from the reserve.
Right.
And so I think for some, it's just easy to point fingers. And say,
it's important to remember, too, that based on the area you represent, so that I'm on the Finance Committee on the House, and then you've got a Finance Committee on the Senate side, and you've got rural legislators, I'm a West Knox guy, yeah, you've got urban legislators. So we each have our own priorities and initiatives, that one is for your district, and yep, then it's two for the state. And so that really does drive the budget process, because, man, I mean, like for me, I don't have some personal agenda. I have the agenda of the 65,000 people in West Knoxville that voted for me to send me there. That is my initiative, and that's the motivation to do anything that I do. And so that's what kind of really drives the budget process, when you have all these meetings and there's initiatives and focuses, and then you get to a point where you have some leverage when the Senate Finance Committee wants a certain thing. Well, the House doesn't see that as a priority. Well, if you guys want that, this is a priority to us. Mm-hmm. So we're going to ask you to take the time to move it forward. And that's exactly what happened with the pro-life bill. And it was easy to kind of come to an agreement on that, because Lieutenant Governor McNally, the Senate, I mean, they are pro-life.
Yeah, it's not they are pro-life.
Oh, right, absolutely. Yeah. It's just, man, that's such a heavy lift. Can we get to it? And they said, you know what, even though it's after midnight, it's worth it. Yeah. This is important enough. Let's get this done.
Well, and I think there's certain issues, and for me and you, life being the most important issue, where it's worth the heavy lift.
Yeah, without a doubt.
It's worth the back and forth. It's worth the saying, okay, we'll give you this, but you got to – If you don't vote on this, we're not going to give you that.
Right.
And that's not underhanded. That is
– No.
That's negotiations.
That's exactly
how the process works. And so from that standpoint, that's where my frustration came in of, oh, they did it in the cover of the night. They did it, you know, it late at night. And it was like, well, they had to get through session.
Yeah, it happened. And so then we broke a record that last day. Depending on when you count the actual start time, some people started when our committee started versus when we actually were on the floor with session. It was roughly a 19 and a half hour day. I mean, that was the time the committee started. We didn't get done until after 4:30 in the morning. So, man, I mean, it was, and again, it's all, you can watch it on TV. It's all streamed. You can watch it. And so there was nothing, everything that was done in front of the cameras.
Yeah.
It was debated. And so the Senate, I don't remember how long it went on, but it went on well over an hour debate on this bill. On a bill that you knew it was going to pass, because it's 28 Republicans and 5 Democrats, it was going to pass.
Man, it's so different than when I worked at
the Oh, gosh, yeah. And so we're the supermajority, so we knew it was going to pass. But
they debated
it. Absolutely. Yeah. The time was still taken to do that. And again, it's the most extensive pro-life legislation that's ever been passed.
I think that's what we're going to the next segment, we're going to kind of look at the bill itself. What does it involve? I think explaining some of the aspects of it, of the laddering and what that looks like, and why we put the ladder in there and what that means, and the abortion pill reversal and so many things that come into effect. And some people may go, what do you mean abortion pill reversal?
Right.
It's an amazing thing that we have that nobody knows about, that you can actually take a pill after taking the abortion pill, depending on how much time has passed.
Reverse that. Yep.
And you can reverse it. And babies are walking around today because their mom took that pill because they regretted what they decided to do and took an abortion pill reversal, and now a baby is living because of it. We're going to talk more about that when we come back. So I know there's a lot to talk about, and there's even a Supreme Court decision that was made just this week concerning a Louisiana law, a pro-life law. And look, I'm going to talk about that in a week or so, I promise. But today I wanted to focus on what's going on in the state of Tennessee and some pretty important legislation that was passed. And Jason just happened to be at the beach last week and couldn't come on the show. So we said we would talk about it this week. So some very extensive pro-life legislation, really led by the governor's office. He wanted this.
Absolutely.
It was a push. And I'll be honest, Last year, we had a big cluster in Nashville when it came to pro-life legislation. You had right-to-life folks, and you had other people upset with each other. You had there was a summer study session where you had right-to-life lobbyists agreeing with abortion lobbyists. And it's like, what are we talking about? Crazy. What are we doing? And so it was so nice this year to go, oh, everybody seems seems okay. There may be some things that we would like to change about this bill, but for the most part, this is where we wanted to get to. So give us a quick summary, a rundown of what that piece of legislation calls for and why it's important.
Well, and I think it's important to know, too, that drafting of this, so the governor went around, and this was the governor's initiative. The governor's 100% pro-life, and
Absolutely.
This was one of the most important things to him. And so he had legal experts from around the country weigh in on this because everybody knows it's going to be challenged. Judge Campbell already said, I think it was yesterday, put out a statement saying it's Planned Parenthood ACLU is already trying to challenge it. He put a statement out saying yesterday that, listen, until the governor signs this, we're not having a conversation about this because the governor hadn't signed it yet. He will, but it hasn't been signed yet. And so the governor's gotten the best legal minds in the country to work on this and draft this in a way that will be able to what they feel like will uphold the standard and rulings of the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, when it gets to the Supreme Court, which it probably will, this will be upheld. But I mean, the provisions include no abortion after a heartbeat's detected, the heartbeat bill. It also includes the requirement of an ultrasound. As you know, working at Hope, 86% of women choose life when they see that baby moving in the womb. It's huge. Yeah. Requiring an ultrasound before every abortion.
Very big deal.
And then another aspect is that when you know a abortion is being performed because of race, the sex, or a disability, it can't be performed when you know that's the motivation. I know you see that at Hope. And then the other things are it's got the ladder provision where it's got so many different ladders in terms of number of weeks that for a court ruling as it goes through courts, it's got the ladder provision where I think it starts at like 6 weeks and it just goes 6, 8, 10, 12. And so literally they would have to strike down every single one of those. Then it's got a severability clause to where, for example, if the courts find that the motivation by race, sex, or disability, they throw that out and strike that down, that still leaves in the ultrasound and the heartbeat. So they took into account the case in Ohio, the case in Kentucky. I mean, it really was. This was a labor-intensive, legally exhaustive process that they went through to draft this legislation, and man, it's fantastic. And it truly is the most extensive piece of pro-life legislation that's ever been passed in the nation. I mean, I'm proud to have been a part of it and to help get this move through the House. And now we just need to be in some serious prayer. I mean, this is one of those things I texted with Pastor Randy Davis, who's the executive director of Tennessee Baptist Association, just asking
him.
He's
a good dude.
Oh, he's awesome. Yeah. And I was like, man, please tell the churches they need to be talking about this. The body of believers needs to be praying that we find favor. Psalm 5:12, the Lord will surround this with his favor as this move through the courts, because we need his divine hand to take this through, because this literally could be the trajectory that saves millions of lives in years to come.
I mean, think about this, Jason. If we could be, we believe we live in the greatest state in the union already.
Yep.
But just think.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, for me, this is the issue. I was talking to somebody today, and I said, look, there's a lot of issues that concern me.
Right.
But none to policy when it comes to a civilized society, all of those things. And so would it be amazing if the state of Tennessee passed the piece of legislation, and you were a part of that General Assembly that passed the piece of legislation that finally got to see us get to a place where life was celebrated? I mean, I can just imagine it if it gets there. What Clarence Thomas would say about it, because he would love it.
Sure.
But as we think through that, look, folks, the reality is there are parts of this country and parts of this world where there are certainly parts of this world that have said we have eliminated Down syndrome from our population. Do you know what that means? Mm. That means they've aborted every patient, every baby that is diagnosed with Down syndrome while in the womb. They abort them. So they haven't eliminated Down syndrome, they've eliminated humans is what they've done. And then they act as if science has helped them do that. There's places in this country that would, and then there's politicians and people in this country that would say we need abortion on demand for any reason at any point in time. And literally right before they're delivering the baby, they should be able to abort it. They believe that. Mm. They believe that fully. And so this isn't a flippant kind of, oh, well, this is, you know, behind the scenes, under the cover of night. Look, this is important stuff. And if you listen to this show every week, you know that this is important stuff. And this isn't something that we just go, well, we hope it works. No, the hours and the time that were put into this was put into this because we believe that every life bears the image of God and deserves protection. And certainly the most vulnerable in our society are those in the womb. And so I think about it often as I think about politicians who take an oath to represent their constituency. If I was an elected official, I would consider that unborn person as part of my constituency.
Sure.
And just like you would consider the person that may be in the nursing home, the other vulnerable populations that don't have a voice as part of your constituency, even if they don't get out and vote for you, they're part of your constituency. No one is speaking for the unborn, and this piece of legislation gets us to a place where the state of Tennessee and the governor of the state of Tennessee is saying, this matters so much to us that we are going to take the time and put in the effort and pass this piece of legislation because we want to protect life within the state of Tennessee. And that's what happens. You know, there's a lot of folks who are like, oh, I can't, you know, Tennessee's so hateful. And I'm going, well, you don't have to live here.
That's right. Yep.
Even if Roe v. Wade is overturned, it goes back to the states.
Right.
And so New York can go crazy with it.
Yeah.
And like they have. And so as you have blue states, pro-abortion states, positioning themselves for a day when Roe is overturned, why can't red states, pro-life states, position themselves
right
for the day when Roe is overturned?
Thing. Yeah, that's right.
It just seems logical that those things would occur. And I'm grateful that the state of Tennessee decided this is worth the time and worth the effort. After it was done, and of course, I know it was late, and y'all probably were all like, hey, let's go home. but what has some of the conversations been like with other legislators and even constituents after that vote was done? And I'm sure it's been mixed and up and down, but what's that been like?
Yeah, very rarely do we have votes that we take where there's high-fiving, hugging, even in COVID, even in right. quarantine, man, people are hugging, high-fiving. Yeah. I mean, it was a big deal because, I mean, you had some of the ladies got emotional about it. Some of our ladies who were fought so hard for this got really emotional because, I mean...
Hold on, you mean ladies are pro-life?
Oh, man,
I thought the narrative was they weren't pro-life. Yeah. They are pro-life.
They are
okay.
pro-life.
Awesome.
Yeah,
of course.
The ladies I work with are pro-life.
Of course they are. Me too.
And
I work with 14 of them.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, it was just, we were exhausted, but it was just a relief that we got this done. I can't believe we got this done. And literally, this could be the catalyst for changing everything. Tennessee had the fewest abortions we've ever had since Roe v. Wade of 73. We had the fewest abortions we've ever had in our state in 2016 or 17. That's the latest numbers we have. And so we're moving in the right direction. Yeah. We've passed since Governor Haslam was elected and the General Assembly became a conservative Republican majority. We've passed so many incremental pro-life bills that have gotten us to this point. But man, this was the hammer.
Yeah.
And it's worth fighting for. And I'm not backing down from that. We're gonna stay there where we are. We're not moving from that. And we really feel comfortable that this will be upheld as it goes through. But we need the divine hand of our Lord and God and Savior on this as it walks through. And we just need his favor because it's going to go through.
Oh, and it's going to be messy.
There's
no question.
Yep.
And as we see that, that's why it's so important to be engaged in the process and understand what's going on. Because what I think is going to happen is other states are going to see this and go, okay, that's what we need to do.
That's right.
That's the legislation we need to pass. And so you're going to see conservative states. And here's the thing. I was talking about the Supreme Court ruling about what happened in Louisiana. All Louisiana did was pass a law saying if you're an ambulatory surgery center, you should have admitting privileges at a hospital.
That's right.
And
that's
all they're wanting to do is say if you're an abortion clinic or any other ambulatory center, you should have admitting privileges because we want to make sure that our patients are protected.
Right.
And the abortion industry lost their mind. And the interesting thing about Louisiana, Democratic governor, an African-American Democrat authored the bill.
Right.
And the Supreme Court just this week, because of Justice Roberts, which we could spend hours on, ultimately said, no, you can't require the abortion industry to do things that's going to infringe on what they call the right to abortion. And so so it's not about protecting women, because if it was about protecting women, they would want to protect
right.
women.
Right.
And it's the same conversation I had last week on this show. If they really cared as as much as they say they do, about women's rights, then they would provide all of these services at no cost.
Right.
And it wouldn't be a billion-dollar industry. It's a billion-dollar industry because they care deeply about their budget lines, and they charge money, whether it be from insurance, from states, or from the patient themselves, to get these services done. And so I love seeing that Tennessee, maybe, and time will tell, become the model that other states around the country are going to look and go, that's what we're passing next session. And I would venture to guess that y'all, House members, are going to have phone calls from legislatures across the country
saying, there's no doubt.
What do we need to do? How do we get this passed? I think Governor Lee's going to have calls from governors across the country. And man, wouldn't it be awesome if the president himself would say, this is a model.
Yeah.
This is the model moving forward. We'll talk more with Jason Zachary when we come back. So today, Jason Zachary was gracious enough to join me in studio to talk about some amazing things that are occurring in the state of Tennessee. And I wanted to kind of give you the full gambit in looking at the pandemic and looking at what the legislature did, but also looking at the pro-life legislation. Jason, what's it look like for the fall? I guess my question is, will Neyland Stadium be full in the fall? Do you have an answer for us right now? What's your hot take?
What I can give you. Like? I can give you my opinion.
Okay,
I don't have any inside information to give, but I really do think we'll start out with fans in the stands. I don't think there's any doubt.
Full on. You think though?
Man, if I have to bet money, so I always say that.
Sure,
if I had to bet money, I would say no, it won't be full. They'll be put some sort of limitation on it. Just because, man, I mean, you're talking about that's June, July, August. I mean, that's 3 months
long.
Away.
Yeah. And the my thing is, if it's not at max capacity, okay, and we're expecting big things. Pruitt has got the team in the right direction.
Yeah, this is a year.
So if it's not max capacity, how do you decide? There's so many season ticket holders. How do you decide is it a lottery? Is it a because some folks are going to be like, well, I donated to get these season tickets. So that's going to be the interesting thing that plays out.
Oh, I've already had people say to me, man, I've had those seats. I've been donating and had those seats for 30 years.
Yeah.
I will be sitting in those seats.
And so it's going to be interesting to see.
Because so you'll give priority season ticket holders.
Yeah.
So then what do you do after that? I mean, do you spread out the season?
Yeah, let's just call President Randy Boyd up now.
Let me get him on speaker.
Right,
and we'll put him on. Hey.
But it is going to be, I mean, those are some tough decisions.
Oh, without a doubt.
Tough decisions.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing about it is for looking
and
at
we
it,
also know some of those seats are super close to each
other. Oh, man, there's no doubt about that. Literally on top of each other.
Like there's no plexiglass that's going in between every seat. Although that might make it a better experience.
Well, that'd be something. I don't know if everybody could fit in those plexiglass partitions. But I mean, the thing about it is from a football perspective, absolutely, man. I'm as big a walnut
as
anybody. I want us playing. But from a revenue perspective,
Knox County,
the mayor and I have talked about it. I mean, those 8 weeks or 8 to 9 weeks, typically 8 weeks that people come here and there's 100,000 people packed in that stadium, the revenue that drives in Knox County needs that revenue.
Well, the businesses on the strip, they need that.
I mean, we're all sales tax driven. And so based on what we're coming out of, 2 months of loss, basically, I mean, we really need that revenue. So it's a ton of pressure on the university for the dependency that we have for them to take that step. And again, not just football, but you got basketball right after that with the Vols, the Lady Vols. And so those are things our community needs. And the reality is that with this COVID mess, I tweeted about this a couple of days ago, that it was all about flattening the curve.
Yep.
We did that. We flattened the curve. It was about PPE. It was about ventilators. It was about beds. Man, we did what we were supposed to do. We're not going to eliminate it. It's probably one of those things that until there is a rock solid vaccine, it's here. And it's got
to even when we get the vaccine, we don't have a rock solid flu vaccine at the moment.
Gosh.
So it's just going to be one of those things. I was listening to some hospital administrators out of Houston, and they're like, look, some reporting is saying that we're at max capacity. We are not.
Right.
We're completely prepared, and we could have a lot more.
Yeah.
And we're ready for that.
Right.
And that's been the process of getting ready for what that may look like. And so it is going to be interesting to see what the fall looks like, not just at UT, but for our county schools,
that's
for private schools,
and
for all of these things. And so, man, it's just going to be, I've kind of chalked 2020 up as the, we're even looking at our events for Hope Resource Center, and it's kind of the virtual year. We're just going to go probably all of 2020, except for our golf tournament, because I don't really know how to do that virtually.
That'd be a challenge.
We're going to go virtual on a lot of things, and that's just what 2020 is going to look like for a lot of people. And trying to figure it out and trying to navigate. So I would encourage people to pray for our leaders. I mean, our mayors, our governor, our state reps, they are making some very difficult decisions. And I think a lot of times it's easy. Look, I'm an opinionated dude, and I have a lot of opinions about a lot of things. And sometimes it's easy to kind of sit back and just throw hate in their direction. Now, sometimes that's warranted. A 34% tax increase,
yeah,
you're going to get some bad
bombs
vibes.
Away, baby. Yeah.
But man, there's some tough things that they're having to walk through and really decide and talk through. And I think with Governor, you know, putting together the economic team of saying, look, how do we get our place back
right.
open? How do we get us to a place where we can open businesses, keep people safe, but get this economy back going? So be praying for your leaders. They would appreciate it. And here's a crazy idea. Every now and then, send them a positive message of, hey, we appreciate you.
Man, I would love that. You would not believe
it. I read your comment threads, man.
Lord have mercy. You wouldn't believe it.
It's a mess. And so every now and then, just send them a nice, hey, man, we appreciate what you're doing. We're praying for you. Even if you disagree with them, just go, we're praying for you.
Yeah, that's right.
And we hope the Lord would move in your life in a mighty way.
That would be refreshing. Rarely do those come in.
They would really appreciate it. And so do that. Jason, thanks so much for hanging out with me today. We'll talk to y'all next week.